The following podcast is a part of RadioMisfits.com.
In April of 2023, we agreed to pause production of Carol's Last Christmas to allow police to investigate some of the leads our team developed.
Even though we told them we wouldn't put out new episodes for a while, we have to have some new episodes.
Well, it's been it's been a while. Yeah. That's why we're here.
It's officially a while.
We believe normal detectives are now devoting significant effort to this cold case. That break also afforded us time to research other unsolved attacks on women from the same era and in the same area, the Twin Cities of Bloomington and Normal. The similarities remain remarkable.
I grew up in Bloomington Normal. I was born in the Chicago area, but moved to Bloomington with my dad because he worked for State Farm. And so when I was looking at schools, I went to ISU because I was an art major. And at that time, and they still do, from what I understand, have a really good art program. I just decided I was going to pledge a sorority. I don't know why, but it was really brand new. Delta Zeta was like one of the most popular ones that you wanted to be in. They had a big orientation. But I think it was a week. You would visit all the different sororities. Delta Zeta, of course, was one of them. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of narrowed down as the week went on the ones you wanted to go back to. And then you hope that the sorority would offer you as well an invitation to come back. I think what I was initially struck with so much was how much the girls in the house truly enjoyed each other. Like, they would put on little skits, and there was always a theme of some kind, and sing some songs. And it struck me that they were really genuine, and they really cared about each other. And I just thought, you know, I want that. I want to be friends with them. So that's how I ended up there. And that would have been the fall of 1974.
A few months earlier, in July of 1974, a carefree summer had turned frightening for one member of the house. She was awakened in the middle of the night by an intruder that no one got a good look at, except for his green army-style pants.
When I was rushing the house, you know, on one of the visits when you're trying to find out where you're going to land, that's when I met Carol. And I had a conversation with her before I even pledged the house. And she told me about Mr. Green Jeans. But I guess they didn't want to scare potential pledges away. It was like, oh, it just happened. And it's kind of funny. We named him Mr. Green Jeans. And we just all thought it was like a random, some guy did it and she was okay, and everybody had decided to move on.
But there would be no moving on. 16 months later, just days before Christmas 1975, Carol was bludgeoned outside the house and died. And the following spring, another middle-of-the-night break-in, nearly a carbon copy of Mr. Green Jeans.
Here's what we recalled. Liz was living in the basement apartment at that time. And she was studying, doing an all-nighter for an anatomy test. And she said it was somewhere between 3 and 4 a.m. They heard loud noises and screaming. So Liz ran up the two flights of stairs because this was coming from upstairs. And when she got there, the fire escape door was open. That door was wide open. And Diane had collapsed onto the floor and was sobbing and crying. You know, what happened? And Diane told her that her and Barb, the other girl, were in their room sleeping. And, you know, there were twin beds. They were side by side. A man came in and he had a stocking over his face. He picked up Barb by the throat and threw her into a desk. She collapsed onto the floor, and then he turned and picked up Diane. Interestingly enough, she was wearing little baby doll pajamas. Liz remembers all this, but and he pinned her arms behind her back and drug her out of the apartment and told her not to make any noise or he would kill her. And she was pleading with him the whole time, like, don't hurt me, you know, I'll do what you want me to, please don't hurt me, please don't hurt me. And he tried to drag her out the door and down the steps, and she resisted. And he said, if you don't, you know, come with me, I'll throw you off this balcony. And that's when she decided, I'm in a bad position. I'm going to scream my head off. We don't remember the police coming to the house. And I think they just wrote it off like this was a fraternity prank. And what happened afterwards is Diane, she had called her parents right away. They picked her up, packed her up, took her, re-enrolled her in Western University, and we never saw or heard from her again.
From Genuine Human Productions, this is Carol's Last Christmas.
This guy had a mask on. It wasn't somebody pulling a prank on us.
Chapter 12. Thought somebody told you.
We have chosen to omit names or use sound effects in this production because the individuals discussed have not been formally arrested, charged, or accused of wrongdoing in the death of Carol Rofstead. The Normal Police Department declined to participate in this podcast.
To be quite honest, I'm surprised that in all of us that you've talked to, nobody mentioned it. Because I just figured you guys knew.
Okay, so this is an Illinois State Unsolved Crime Memo, page 1 of 2. A homicide investigation, Carol Rofstead. The address was 602 South Fell Street, Normal, Illinois.
Apart from Carol's murder, it's hard to know exactly what happened at 602 South Fell Street in Normal, Illinois.
Carol was 21 when she was killed.
On cases like assault or sexual battery, the Normal Police Department keeps records and files only 7 years. It's been nearly 50 years since this case happened. So we have to rely on memories and media reports.
When I started thinking about this attack, in my mind, I'm thinking, if you look at Diane's picture, she has long blonde hair.
And you've got to think, okay, first you have almost the same MO throwing Carol, you know, picking her up out of bed, throwing her across the room.
At the same address, 602 South Fell Street.
Wearing the same type of pajamas, okay? That's the thing that killed me. And maybe I'm not a detective, but my mind just went there. Maybe I watched too much TV. I don't know. But I'm thinking, why did he throw Barb on the floor and then turn around to Diane? I don't know any fraternity that would actually break into our house and grab a girl by the throat and then grab the other girl and pin her arms back and try and drag her down the stairs. Then, I don't know if it was after the attack, we started getting prank, I don't want to call them prank phone calls because they weren't prank, they were threatening phone calls.
It was the 70s. The girl shared one house telephone.
Marilyn, she walked in downstairs, went to the apartment, and the phone rang, and she answered it. And it was a man, a male voice, and said, I know you're alone in the house. I'm going to kill you. And then I'm going to kill everybody else in the house. It scared her terribly.
All this strange behavior, all this violence at the same address. And remember, to an old cop like George Seibel, there are no coincidences.
I'm far more sure that the same person who killed Carol also is the person who tried to rape her in her apartment.
Could the same person have attacked Diane in her baby doll pajamas in the spring of 77? Could the same person have broken into another house on Fell in 1978?
We were on the corner, 609 Fell.
When we come back, a crime normal police can find nowhere in their files. But the newspaper covered it, and the victim will never forget.
All my roommates had left for Christmas vacation, and I was going to work another couple of days.
Oh my gosh, that sounds exactly like Carol's setup.
I know. He had either a ski mask, because it was December, or he had a stocking. Something was over his face.
The happy music is always an eerie reminder. The 21-year-old Carol Rofsted didn't live to see Christmas Day. For her family and many friends, life has never been quite the same. And who could imagine, 3 years after Carol was attacked, perhaps 3 years to the day.
It was the 21st or 22nd, I'm thinking it was a Wednesday night.
Another woman was awakened in the night, just a few doors away.
We were on the corner, 609 Fell, and it just was a big old house. You walked in, and the steps were right there to go upstairs where the bedrooms were. All my roommates had left for Christmas vacation, and I was going to work another couple of days. I worked for an anthropologist.
On campus?
Yeah, recording data. I had dinner with a friend of the group and his girlfriend that night, and I remember them asking me if, you know, I wanted to stay by them. You know, and I was always a little afraid of things anyway, a little anxious. And I was trying to be strong. And I said, nope, I can make it.
This is middle of the night, pitch dark, right?
3 o'clock in the morning, yeah. I heard the stairs creaking, and I was trying to tell myself that I'm just hearing things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Like I said, my bedroom was at the top of the stairs. And I'm somehow, we had had a party at our house, you know, kind of a going end of semester going away. So I had a feeling that he knew I was there. I could hear him walk by, but he walked by my room, checked the other bedroom. It's like he kind of knew the place, you know. And then he came back in to my room and flipped on the light, and I looked back. That's when I turned around. I was in the bottom bunk instead of my normal top bunk bed. And all I know is he kind of jumped into the bed and pretended or said he had a gun. And then I still fought. He hit my head against the bedpost.
Wow, and, just also just like Carol.
Yeah. He put a pillowcase over my head. And that's when he took my pajama bottoms off, and I was still trying to fight. And then after he had taken my pajama bottoms off, I just said, "Please don't hurt me." And he said, "I don't want to hurt you." And he ran out of the house. I went out. I left the house. And I ran to Waterson Towers from there. And it happened to be the last night that they were open for Christmas break. They were going to be closed after that night. So I remember feeling lucky that they were there. And I went in, and whoever was working at the desk, I think, called the police.
There was never an arrest, and there are no longer any police documents to read.
I have a little memorabilia box.
Only the newspaper articles she's kept.
And I probably went through that box once a year and reread that.
And the memories that have been so hard to shake.
It is something that has been part of who I am for my, you know, 44 years. So it's crazy, you know. I've gradually, you know, gotten better, and some anxiety medication has really helped. But my biggest accomplishment was just a few weeks ago. We bought a new house in Arizona, and I had never been there. And my husband and I were supposed to be there together, but he had a friend that was very sick, so he had to go back to Chicago. And I had to stay at this new house that was very unfamiliar to me by myself for a week, and I did it.
attacks on women in Normal in the 1970s had a lot of similarities.
Yeah, he came in through a window and he snipped my phone line.
Somebody broke through that door, cut the phone line, went directly up to her room.
I think it was Jackie, the president of the sorority, tried to call the police, and all the telephone wires had been cut.
A man came in, and he had a stocking over his face.
He had something over his head, for sure.
She said he hit me into the dresser.
Picked up Barb and by the throat and threw her into a desk.
And right across was Carol. The door to her bedroom was open. She was in a pink, like teddy.
Interestingly enough, she was wearing little baby doll pajamas.
And you could argue he might have had a type because you sent me your picture.
He was obsessed about blonde women.
Boy, I got on the Facebook page and saw her picture, and I'm like, holy shit.
In Carol's case, there were strong local suspects. But these other crimes, could they have been committed by an infamous serial killer?
Mid-January 1978, the Chi Omega sorority house. In the early morning hours, through a back door, the intruder came in, carrying an oak tree limb. Most Chios had come back from their dates and gone to bed. That's where the intruder found Margaret Bowman, asleep. She never woke up. She died in her bed, beaten, strangled, sexually molested. Further down the hall, Lisa Levy was asleep. She, too, died without regaining consciousness. At autopsy, the medical examiner noted, measured, and photographed a double bite mark on her body. Still further down the hall, roommates Karen Chandler and Kathy Kleinert survived their attacks. Both were asleep. Neither woke up till they were in the hospital. Neither saw their attacker. Ted Bundy had become a national figure. Newspaper copy described him as perhaps the most prolific killer of young women in the history of the nation.
Bundy's massacre at the Chi-O house in Florida was in January 1978. But that was 11 months before this woman was jumped in the middle of the night, and Bundy had already been in custody.
I do believe that this was not the one and only time this person did this, you know. He was too methodical about stuff.
It now seems unlikely that Ted Bundy will ever leave Florida, and unlikely also that law enforcement officials will ever know for sure if he is the mass murderer they've accused him of being.
Turns out Normal's lead detective did consider a link to Ted Bundy in Carol's case.
But here in the West, there are still unanswered questions in a number of murder cases.
They even questioned him in 1989 before he was ultimately executed.
It is further ordered that on such scheduled date that you be put to death by a current of electricity sufficient to cause your immediate death, and such current of electricity shall continue to pass through your body until you are dead.
According to a 1991 article in the Pantograph newspaper, Ted Bundy denied killing Carol Rofstead. And we have yet to speak to any of the women involved. But in October of 1978, nearby Illinois Wesleyan University had a sorority crime of its own. Someone broke into the Alpha Omicron Pi house at 5:30 in the morning, molested five young women, and raped a sixth. Coincidentally, I transferred to Illinois Wesleyan beginning in 1979. And my co-producer and niece, Allie, graduated from there in 2018. To this day, sorority women are still talking about that unsolved case. The 1970s were certainly a different time. Before databases. Before instant information sharing. There were few, if any, rape crisis centers.
there wasn't support, or we didn't know of any support. You know, you felt you just had to be tough, buck up, and move on, you know? You feel dirty, you feel like you did something wrong, and you just push it down, you know? You should have been stronger, you should have fought harder, you should have, all this stuff, you know? And the police did make me feel like it was my fault.
How?
And I'm like, I was at home in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. How is this my fault?
No one knew the acronym PTSD.
A number of years later, after I had my kids and stuff, I did go to counseling for about 7 years.
As we've said, apart from murder cases and others where the statute of limitations is unlimited, records are generally destroyed in 7 years. We're relying on the memories of those who lived through this time. And information that may not have seemed important back then, but could certainly be now.
After I listened to the podcast, and I listened to it twice, and I thought to myself, you know, you can't be upset about this if you aren't willing to help or do something. And I had a little box of memories in my basement that probably haven't been open for 30 years or so. And that's where I had the pictures of the sorority, you know. Mm-hmm. And I found the newspaper articles from the Pantograph. And that's when I thought, you know, maybe it's nothing, maybe it's something, but at least I can sleep at night knowing I did what I could. And that's why I'm reaching out to my other sorority sisters, because I think they would feel the same way.
And honestly, you never know. It could turn things in a totally different direction.
Carol's Last Christmas is a Genuine Human production, reported from interviews with friends, family, and experts, and based on official records obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. Lead investigator George Seibel, Chicago Police Department, retired. Investigator and co-producer Alexandra Daskalopoulos. Investigator, writer, and narrator Demetria Kaladimos. Voiceover recreation Justin Holder. Audio mastering and consultation by Paul Gibson. Music provided rights free by Artlist, Blue Dot Sessions, Motion Array, and Storyblocks. Original music by Verlin Thompson. Graphics by Orlando Rodriguez and Thalia Kaladimos. Website and promotional material, Thalia Kaladimos and Jim Champas. Our theme song is Criminal by Binge Heard, featuring Katrina Stone, courtesy of Artlist. Carol's Last Christmas is distributed by Radio Misfits. Our sincere thanks to the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press for pre-publication review, and to those who knew and loved Carol and generously shared their stories.